Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. What does the possible departure of the all-ages music venue The Smell mean for downtown Los Angeles?
I like to think that a good city needs a little element of danger. Who wants to come to a city that's gentrified, that's full of high-rises? Like, you know, that takes the heart out of the city, really.
A look at the downside of downtown's growth coming up. And would you like to see better sidewalks or fixed lanes for autonomous cars? Listen up for a debate on how transit expansion funds should be spent in the future as Metro's board prepares for a vote on a new transportation sales tax this Thursday. Meanwhile, there's another vote taking place this Thursday in the United Kingdom, and that's about Brexit, or Britain's exit from the European Union. Voters will choose to leave or remain in the EU. Well, last Thursday, Joe Cox, an admired member of the British Labour Party and a supporter of staying in the EU, was gunned down as she met with her constituents in Yorkshire in the north of England. Her assassination by a Leave supporter shocked a nation unused to gun violence and cast a spotlight on the referendum whose stakes had been unclear to many. But among those that stand to be directly affected by Thursday's outcome are designers and manufacturers trading in Europe. So how and why does it matter? Christopher Farr is creative director of his own contemporary rug and design company with showrooms in West Hollywood and London.
It's beginning to impact now the reality that in a couple of days' time this vote's going to take place. And I'm not alone in wondering how the fallout's going to be for designers and people like me with showrooms in London and Los Angeles. It's going to impact, I think, more on the fabrics, the textile side of my business, where we source materials from Italy and from Spain. And I think costs, if we leave the European single market, then I think costs are going to go up. No one's saying for sure, but I think the cost of doing business will be reflected on the prices that we have to charge.
And it has an effect on the companies working in the UK that are going to be importing from Europe. And then to the extent there's a knock-on effect on the American consumer, it's when that product then comes here for sale.
Yes, that's right. That's really where we'll begin to see prices go up. Is going to be more problematic now. We've got used to, we've had the common market, the single market for over 25 years or whatever. And the trade agreement between the European Union and the United States is very solid and firm, and everybody knows what they're doing. Now we're not going to know.
And one of the other exchanges that happens within the fashion industry, that happens within your industry, is the cross-bordering of designers.
Absolutely.
Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think for me that's the most the emotional side of this issue is that, say, the Royal College of Art, which is one of the major design institutions in the world, they have 65 nationalities in their student body. And many of them come from Europe. In fact, London is seen by many young Europeans as New York is to the United States. It's the place they go to find who they are, to work in our great art schools and all the rest of it. Now, that free exchange will no longer be happening if we leave the European market. And I think that's going to have a huge impact on British design. And also, all the grads are always, they're trawled by the great design companies from Italy and Spain and France who come to the degree shows and buying talent, British talent, which is exported to the European Union.
So British talent gets exported over to France, to Milan.
To the big design companies.
And in reverse, one has French, German, Belgian, Spanish, Italian, you name it, students that go to schools in England. And now that's going to be trickier because they're going to have to get visas if Brexit passes.
Yes, that could take 4 or 5 months. It's expensive to do. You have to have lawyers and so on and so forth. I mean, they're going to put obstacles in the way. And there's no, we don't know politically and emotionally what our former partners are going to view. the British and whether they're going to penalize us in any way. There's lots of scare talk about that, that there might be tariffs and so on and so forth. But I think it's the sort of intellectual exchange that's the balance is going to change now.
Now, there's a very prominent British designer, James Dyson. He is the founder, the creator of the Dyson vacuum cleaner company. And he has gone to the mat saying that the UK should leave Europe. What's his argument and what do you think of it?
Well, you know, far be it from me to say that Mr. Dyson is self-serving. I mean, his main markets actually United States and Asia. Those two markets are much more important to him than Europe. And so he's going on about, no, we buy more from Europe than they buy from us. And therefore, it's going to be better for Britain to stay out and be independent. And also, he's very concerned about the European Union actually does make it very difficult for him to employ great designers or engineers or tech people from outside the European Union. That's what he's upset about right now. The European Union, because it's such a sort of stranglehold on the way that we do business in Great Britain, is inhibiting his company in getting those great brains to come in and work in his company. It can take 4 or 5 months to get a visa.
For someone from Asia.
From Asia, exactly.
Or from America.
It's all like he has to get people from Europe. That's where that's his beef.
Which is a legitimate beef. I mean, that has been the beef, as it were,
against
the EU since its founding, which is the
European
one of the
beef,
frustrating. What do you remember the Butter Mountains?
The Butter Mountains, absolutely.
Anyway, the EU has
climbed many of them myself.
When we refer to Butter Mountains, what we mean is the surplus of butter that existed at one point.
And grapes and pears and apples and God knows what else. Yes,
right, because the EU does bring with it. It's an open market, but it's also a market of rules and bureaucracy. And that was something that Dyson was complaining about, these annoying little rules.
Yes, I think that's right. And here we are in the country which has really freed up business and deregulated as far as it possibly can. And the bureaucracy is what really upsets. I mean, he has been on many committees. To be fair to him, he's seen the impotence of trying to change things. From within. He has, you know, he's actually worked on those committees and got nowhere, and he's fed up with the stagnation.
Oh, I see. Because one of his issues recently that led to this outburst was over-labeling. He wanted something
labeled.
Yes, that's
right. There's so many different languages on his products, and that's annoying him. And
He wanted one simple, clear label.
Well, I think he would like, one simple language, you know. Probably English. Take a wild guess. I think, you know, who knows? When you're that big, I can't imagine what it's like to be somebody like him. I mean, you know, he's got so many. It's a global market.
So where leaving the EU is fundamentally about trade agreements, the motivation to leave the EU is about the movement of people.
That, I think, is what's going to swing it. It's looking like we're going to leave. And it will be basically the fear of peoples moving into Britain from various different religions and all the rest of it and what might happen.
Well, specifically, if we're going to go there, specifically, it's the thousands of people who are camped out at Calais.
Absolutely.
Trying to get on the Eurostar into London.
Yep.
Breeding fears of deluging the healthcare system.
Absolutely.
Deluging the welfare systems of which Britain is very proud.
Yeah, the social welfare which exists in Great Britain is a very, very attractive if you've come from Aleppo or Damascus or somewhere where there's no doctors available free and all the rest of it. Anything happens to you in England, you do get medical treatment and it's free. And you get education and you get everything else that goes with it.
Place to live.
Place to live. You get on housing lists and so on and so forth. So there's a lot. And it's very, very expensive. And they're beginning to be very, very stretched, those services. And they're very expensive. And I think the borders, they want borders to go back up again. I think a lot, if you like, the silent majority probably think, okay, let's stop now. Let's shut up shop. Let's put the wall up and keep everybody out. I mean, the Australian system is now beginning to be talked about, which cherry picks very carefully who they let in into their country is doctors, you know, people that they need, whatever it happens to be, engineers, teachers, and so on and so forth. I mean, those are the people they want, but they're very picky. And the European Union is free. You know, it's a free migration policy.
So what about your friends or people you do business with in London? Are you hearing from them about how they feel on all of this?
Strangely, remarkably passive. The very British thing. It's like, well, we react when it's too late. You know, it's like Britain used to be famous for buying its pictures too late, you know, and twice the price everybody else had to buy them. I think we've got the message, but I think until it happens, I would say all 90% of the people I know in my position in London, designers, all the designers who go to Milan every year will be voting to stay in. I think any business that's working with Europeans will absolutely not want any change whatsoever.
But the fashion designers have actually spoken out. Vivienne Westwood,
yes.
She's been going out around with her T-shirt.
She said, don't let old people, you know, decide for you. That she wants the young people to say, hey, you know, guess what? I mean, this is very significant because my children have only grown up in with a European Union. I mean, this whole generation that's graduating this year, this June, only know that a single market, there's no question for them that why would our elders and so-called betters be voting to get us out? And it's very hard if you don't know, if you only have one reality. How do you know what that other reality is? And somebody has to sort of spell out to them or walk them through what life will be like without that European Union.
No EasyJet weekends in Berlin.
EasyJet, I think that, yeah, all the costs are going to go up. I think that sort of Prague for the weekend, you know, maybe it's going to be double.
Yeah. That should turn out the youth vote.
That should get them out. Yeah, maybe, yes. The party in Europe now is going to cost you twice as much. We should be doing this campaign, Francis. I think we'd have to sort of say that it's going to hurt you there.
Christopher Farr has a rug and design showroom in West Hollywood and London. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA.
Darling, you've got to let me know. Well, should I stay or should I go?
Coming up after this break, this November, LA County voters will have a chance to approve billions of dollars in more transit funds. The question is, how should it be spent? And is it time for Metro to factor in autonomous cars? And news of the Smell's possible closure in downtown LA has caused a bad smell among young rock fans. But there may be light at the end of the tunnel.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now?
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. If you rode the Expo line to Santa Monica this past hot weekend, you probably found it packed. So packed that one of the complaints we've heard since the launch of the Expo line extension a month ago is that it's too full. Is that good news for mass transit and does it make you want more of it? Well, back in 2008, LA County voters approved Measure R, a half-cent sales tax. Now Metro wants you to approve another one this November. It's been called Measure R2, and the billions of dollars it would raise over the coming decades will support transportation improvements such as the continued construction of the Crenshaw LAX line, the regional connector in downtown, and the Purple Line extension. It will pay for a $4 billion light rail project connecting Artesia to downtown, as well as highway improvements and bike lanes. This Thursday, Metro board members are scheduled to approve the measure. But how all that sales tax money gets spent is still up for debate. Inglewood Mayor James Butts, also a Metro board member, wrote an op-ed in yesterday's LA Times saying the board's biggest priority should actually be to connect the region's light rail coverage by speeding up the construction of the two north-south light rail lines that are already half-built, the Green and Crenshaw lines. West Hollywood City Council member Lindsay Horvath co-wrote the op-ed.
what Metro's trying to do right now is provide an outline of the key priority projects that they would like to see advanced. But, you know, there are some question marks about some of the projects that have been proposed and, you know, exactly how they would unfold, what at what stage each development would happen. So I think there are still some question marks yet to be resolved. But I think one thing is very clear, and that's we need to further invest in a transportation system that serves the entire county, that is regional, rational, and equitable.
Regional, rational, and equitable. Now, what that means exactly is playing out in transit discussions across the region.
My name is Rudy Espinoza. I'm the executive director of Leadership for Urban Renewal Network. We go by the acronym LURN, L-U-R-N. It's clear that the city of LA needs better transportation systems. So the ballot measure poses an important opportunity. I think what I would personally like to see is an equity lens to the work that's happening. You see oftentimes summer's coming. I was just commenting about the weather. And I think about a lot of the folks that we work with in the valley. And it gets to 100, 110 degrees there, and there's no bus shelters.
Rudy Espinoza is on the advisory board of a group called Investing in Place. It's helmed by Jessica Meany.
One of the things that I care a lot about is how people get to the bus stop and train station. In my transportation policy world, we call that first and last mile access. In Los Angeles County, less than 1% of all of our money has been spent on investments for sidewalks and bicycle lanes and safe routes to school. Yet, almost 40% of our roadway deaths are people walking and biking, a number that spikes in low-income communities and communities of color. So really moving the needle with this new ballot measure that this could be the last one we do. If it's for our lifetime, this is kind of the last chance to go to the voters. So making sure that some of this new public dollars makes our streets and sidewalks safer for all.
But some say this transit debate misses the point and fails to plan for new ways of getting around. Patrick Atwater is a civic data scientist for Argo Labs, or Advanced Research in Government Operations. He has just written an article to be published later this week at Zocalo Public Square's website entitled "Why Do Cities Keep Building Infrastructure That Ignores Self-Driving Cars?" He joined Jessica Meany in our studio and said that we've got to start planning a future paved by autonomous buses.
You know, when you look at light rail, it's a 1% solution for Southern California in terms of ridership. You know, you need a mobility solution that works for the vast, vast majority of people. And it just seems really odd that, you know, when you look at the proposed plan, that they don't even talk about, you know, autonomous vehicles. Picture autonomous bus lanes where it's a structured and a semi-controlled environment. That would get you a lot of what the goals are with light rail, where you have these arterial networks. But it also puts us on a path to being able to have autonomous vehicles at a much larger scale. If you could take an autonomous car that would pick you up where you are, wherever you are, ultimately, and it's like going like an Uber or a Lyft, and it'll take you from point to point. And if it was something that was a ride-sharing service, so there was fuel efficiency and economies of scale and all that sort of thing, and you didn't have to drive to like the expo line or one of these things that's point to point, that you know, LA is really fragmented. The light rail isn't going to cover all of Southern California. It's never going to cover all of Southern California. Even the most optimistic aspects of the plans don't cover all of Southern California. And that just seems kind of, you know, LA was always the city of the future, but it just seems really pessimistic and frankly not really in the character of LA to not be, you know, to be dreaming not quite big enough.
Jessica, what do you think when you hear this?
I have a lot of common ground with what I hear you saying, Patrick. I mean, I think that I hear you talking about a dedicated lane for buses, and I am so hungry for bus rapid transit. I myself have lived in LA since the late 90s and have never owned a car. And you're absolutely right. The light rail does not serve all of Los Angeles County. In fact, those people like myself, people who do rely on transit, 75% of our transit riders are on buses right now. And we're sitting in the same traffic, yet there's 45 of us on a bus with one person a car. So heck yeah, I'm ready for some dedicated bus lanes. But I also think some of the things that I think would resonate with you and this idea, I don't think Metro is completely ignoring this at all, because one of my favorite things about this ballot measure is the dedicated money for what's called state of good repair. So that makes sure that our freeways, our streets, our sidewalks don't have giant potholes, continue to be maintained and continue to be usable. And doing things like on our, we have an impressive freeway network here in Southern California, and thank goodness we're continuing to invest in it to make sure we're not really expanding it. There's a couple of projects that are expanding it, but a lot of money going to maintain our roads and freeways. And I think that makes it eligible and a great opportunity to ensure that when driverless cars do become more ubiquitous, as you said, that our existing infrastructure is in a good quality to kind of handle it and be flexible. For too long, we've been so obsessed with giant capital projects, and we never have enough money to maintain our current networks.
There's an art piece that I think many people will have seen called Metropolis 2. It's at LACMA, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, created by the late Chris Burden, the artist. And that does feature essentially autonomous cars racing around the metropolis. Chris Burden has said that for him, the vision of LA, his kind of imaginary LA, is one in which the autonomous car dominates. Even a few years back, that seemed very futuristic. But what you're saying is it's far nearer us all than we might think. Is that right, Patrick?
Yes, and I think we have a choice in what sort of future we want to create. And I think opportunities like this ballot measure and in terms of how it's implemented, we can chart a future where we start to pilot and start to try and test and move towards a world where autonomous vehicles are there, or we can just expect it to be kind of some sideshow that's off in Silicon Valley. I think a lot of the underlying challenges are how they're deployed in real communities, which requires, you know, the public to be involved, which requires organizations like LA Metro to be involved. And I hope that we can, you know, figure out a way to get that done.
But Jessica Meany, if it's fair to summarize your view, it's human-centered.
Yeah, absolutely. And while I share your optimism for looking to the future, I actually think there's a whole lot of historical wrongs in our mobility and the way we travel in Los Angeles County and have spent our public dollars that need to be righted first. That I'm anxious to see, you know, particularly for our older adults and for our youth who never have shown up in transportation modeling and the data and where we prioritize investment. So I'm optimistic for the future. I think driverless cars are coming. I've seen presentations from Google, and I think that I share with you, Patrick, that keeping this ballot measure flexible, which it does, they have this 10-year review committee, but I'm also really interested in making sure that this ballot measure makes it safe to walk.
Jessica Meany is Managing Director of Investing in Place. Patrick Atwater is a civic data scientist for Argo Labs. Watch for his article on self-driving cars to be published at Zocalo Public Square's website. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Construction cranes currently dot the skyline of downtown Los Angeles, and they signal escalating land values, which is having some unforeseen consequences on the life of the neighborhood. Just this past week, we learned that the Los Angeles Times building near City Hall might be sold to a Canadian developer, meaning Times staffers could wind up leaving a building they have occupied since the 1930s. And meanwhile, just a short walk east, The Smell, a much-loved all-ages music venue on Main Street, is threatened with closure after 17 years. This news has sparked outrage mixed with anxiety that the changes taking place in downtown are not all for the better. DNA producer Avishai Artsy has the story.
It's a Saturday night, and the alley between a parking garage and a row of brick buildings is filled with young people. Tonight's show at The Smell is at capacity, with 200 tickets sold at $5 a piece. Among those waiting for the show to start is Simon Landau. He's 15.
I have a band that I play with, and we've been having just difficulty finding anywhere all ages, because there's a lot of bars in LA that have live musicians, but they're all 21 and over, so it's very rare to find a place that treats the performers well and allows all ages.
Simon's friend Gina Basili is 14. It's her first time coming to The Smell, and she's heard only good things about it.
So it'd be a shame for this place to be demolished because it's such a beautiful, communally oriented place.
What Gene is talking about is a demolition notice that was posted on the door of the Smell just before Memorial Day weekend. It came from L&R Group of Companies, the parking lot developer that purchased a large site on the 200 block of Main Street last year. Jim Smith is the owner of the Smell.
The next day, I posted it online, and there was a pretty incredible outpouring of support.
Other businesses on the block, including the downtown independent movie theater and a gay Latino dive bar called the New Jalisco Bar, also received the notices. But the possible closure of the Smell has received the most attention by far. Fans like Adam Weintraub, who's 17, and Baron Rinsler, who's 18, say they're heartbroken.
I think like it happened in New York with like CBGBs and all that like stuff, and it's kind of inevitable in like any city that's going through like change and gentrification. But I think it takes away like a huge part of the culture, and it just makes it like another bland city.
Yeah.
And it takes away a lot of like the creative like aspects of LA.
I mean, I like to think that a good city needs a little element of danger. But I think, I don't know, man, this is like they're robbing us of all that, you know, goodness. Who wants to come to a city that's gentrified, that's full of high-rises? Like, you know, that takes the heart out of the city, really.
Now, to be clear, L&R Group says there are no immediate plans to demolish the block of buildings or turn it into a parking lot. Kevin Litwin is the company's chief operating officer.
If you look at the footprint of what the theater and the Smell is, if you were to level that, I would get only a handful of spaces really out of it. So on a business perspective, we actually make more money on rents than we would on putting a few cars, additional cars in there. So it doesn't add up.
Litwin met with Jim Smith and offered him a year-long lease in the Smell's current space. He also offered at least 90 days of notice if something were to happen to the building, as well as assistance with finding a new location. Smith says they're weighing their options, but would like a more clear timeline of how long they can stay in their space.
Because, you know, it's difficult to run a business like this if you don't have that certainty, because we book shows months in advance, and there's bands from out of town that, you know, they can't afford to book at a venue if there's any chance that that show might get canceled.
But at least one developer said the Smell has played an important role in a changing downtown. Unfortunately, those change agents sometimes bring about their own demise.
This is an example of the mixed blessing of urban revitalization.
That's Dan Rosenfeld, a real estate developer who works in the private and nonprofit sectors. Now that downtown LA is growing so fast with an influx of new residents and businesses, does it make sense to try and find a way to preserve institutions like the Smell?
Preserving these ventures is going to be difficult in a purely economic age. The value of the land has increased, the rental prices have increased, to some degree the demographics have changed. I don't think it makes good policy sense to try to regulate the uses of these buildings. I think if anything, we need more in the downtown to take some of the development pressure off of the residential neighborhoods. And I'm not worried that there's going to be a shortage of alternative music clubs, that they will find a way.
Musician Nicholas Radigan agrees. His band's Current Joys and Surf Curse play regularly at the Smell.
Even if it does lose this space, there's going to be another space and another space. That's just the nature of DIY venues. You know, like, it's amazing that this one was open for as long as it was. Normally they get shut down in like 1 or 2 years, you know. But I think it's the space itself, it's the alleyway, it's like literally the smells, you know, that like get people so sympathetic and emotional about the place. But I know that, you know, whatever happens, like, this community is not going to go anywhere. You know, there's still these kids in LA, and they still want to play shows and need places to go.
Such clubs do tend to have a short lifespan. Pear Space, located in a strip mall in historic Filipino town, received a 60-day eviction notice earlier this month. Church on York, a renovated church in Highland Park, was shut down in 2014 after it was open for just 1 year. And let's not forget, the Smell itself first opened in North Hollywood in 1998. But less than 2 years later, after that area underwent a boom, the Smell was priced out and moved to downtown. For DNA, I'm Avishai Artsy.
Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's show. It was mixed by Ray Iguana. Special thanks to Jason Broman and Stephanie Case. Thank you very much for listening.